I'm certainly enjoying this study in the book of Esther. It has made me have to do a lot of studying. I was talking to one of my fellow pastors the other day, and he asked me if I was teaching any particular book of the Bible at the present time. I said, yes, I'm going through the book of Esther. He said he never had taught that, and he asked me, he said, do you have to study quite a bit in order to have something to say? I said, yes. Have to study quite a bit in order to get all of that straightened out back over there that happened some 2,500 years ago. In order to understand most of the books in the Old Testament, as well as the book of Esther, we have to project ourselves somehow back into that particular period of time that all of these events happened. It's not easy for our contemporary Baptist people to do that. We tend to relate more to what we know to be so in our own time. And sometimes that's probably why a lot of people find a lot of the Old Testament books hard to understand. And sometimes even I've heard them make the statement that it's boring. I just can't get any sense out of it. Of course, I have one comment to make on that always, and I'd make it now. Most of the time we get out of something what we put in it. If we put a great deal of study into these books in the Old Testament, I believe that we'll reap a great deal of benefit. And if we don't put much into them, then it stands to reason that we wouldn't get much out. That's all illustrated by a story that I heard one time. There was a man who was pastor of a church, and they had an offering box like we do. And so he thought it'd be real good that Sunday morning, get everything off to a good start, so he put a $5 bill in the box. And he always got all the money in it, so when the service was over, he went back there, he and his little boy standing at the box. He opened it up, and it had $5 in it. It was all. So the little boy looked him all over, you know, and said, I tell you what, Daddy, said, if you'd have put more in, said, you'd got more out. So that's the way it is with the Bible. If you put more in, then you'll get more out. So I do hope you'll give some time to read and study these events, though they happened a long time ago. I believe there are some lessons in these books, even like Esther, Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes, and the like. I believe there's some good lessons for us here in this contemporary age. Now we're going to start in chapter 2, and we won't be able to finish all of that because there are a lot of typical lessons that I want to give at the end, and if I did all of that with the chapter, we'd be here pretty late tonight. So I don't want to go too long, but I do want to say enough to whet up your appetite for the next part of the lesson. This book's written more or less in the form of a story, and therefore it is a little more exciting, perhaps, than a deep doctrinal book that people are not able always to relate to as well as they should. Beginning here in chapter 2, verse 1 and 4, we see how that a new queen is sought by King Ahasuerus. And quite a bit of time has elapsed between chapter 1 and chapter 2, as we're going to see in verse 1. So there has been actually something like almost 4 years between what we're going to read about in chapter 2 and what we read about in chapter 1. And that can be seen by comparing part of chapter 2 with part of chapter 1. Let's read that first verse. After these things, that is what was in chapter 1, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. He remembered how that she failed to obey her husband. He remembered how that she was put out of the queenly office because of this disobedience. And as I pointed out in the last lesson, he did very much love Vashti. And if it had not been for the law of the Medes and the Persians that could not be altered or changed, he doubtless would have taken her back to be his wife, even though he had expelled her temporarily. There are some accounts in history that says he was so upset at the fact that these men had advised him to put her away that he had these men killed after that. Now, there's nothing in the Bible to corroborate that. It may have happened, but I don't know. I doubt that it did, because these were very important men in the government. And while he might have been upset, I doubt that he would have been upset to the point that he probably would have taken on all of these very able men close to himself. So that may or may not be true. I'll just mention that for whatever it might be worth. You say, well, now how do you know how much time has elapsed here? Well, in chapter 1, verse 3, we're told that all the events in chapter 1 happened during the time of the third year of the reign of Xerxes. And then in this chapter, in verse 16, we find out that all that's taking place here is in the end of the seventh year of his reign. So when you think about the fact that the seventh year is almost over, as a matter of fact, it is very near being over, the best I can tell, that would mean that about 4 years of time will elapse, and at least three, almost four, the way I would count it. Somebody said, now, do you mean that this king went 4 years without a queen? Well, now remember that he probably had a number of concubines. They were usually called second-hand wives, and he may have had as many as 300 or 400. It was not uncommon at that time. You may recall how that Solomon had a very large number of wives, had 300 wives and 700 concubines. So don't get the idea that all of these old kings didn't have any ladies around, because they did, quite a number of them. But he did not have one that he recognized as a queen. He did not have one that he kept in the palace with himself. All the others were kept in the house of women, or the harem of the king. So he actually had gone, we might say, 4 years without a legal queen sitting up on the throne with him. Somebody said, well, now that was a long time, and why did he delay? Well, the reason is not given in the Bible, but if you read about Xerxes in history, it's not difficult at all to know why that this 4 years had gone by. This was during the time that he was at war with Greece. And most all of the 4 years, if not every bit of it, so far as I can tell, he was away in military campaigns against the Greeks. He went, as far as I can tell from history there, in the fourth year of his reign to Sardis. And he stayed there during the winter. And then in the summer of the year that followed, he was involved in the Battle of Thermopylae. Very important battle in history, if you recall. And then after that, in the year that followed, there were two other battles fought. Very important battles in history. And then after that, he returned back to Sardis. And then finally, after that, to Shushan, the palace in Persia. So really, why that a queen had not been chosen was primarily because the king had just about been gone from the palace and the kingdom of Persia for 4 years. And that's the reason why that no king had been chosen. I'm sure that God had some reasons why a queen had not yet been chosen, but those will come out later. Anyway, that's the way the timetable's working out. Now, I might point out something else. When Xerxes came home, he didn't come home shouting the victory. He came home in defeat. Because in most of those battles with the Greeks, he had been the loser. So I can see a man that has gone out in the battlefield for 4 years. He doesn't have a rightful queen up on the throne with him. He only has all these concubines in the harem. And so he comes home and he says to himself something like this. Well, I've lost out in all my battles abroad. And if I don't set my house in order here in my own kingdom, I'll lose my throne. So what I need is a queen and a rightful heir to follow me on the throne of Persia. So I can see the king, how he reasoned at this time. He said, after all, you know, Vashti has been divorced and driven out as the queen, so I've got to have a new queen if I'm going to be the kind of king that this nation of Persia ought to have. And so he sets out to choose him a new wife. And the idea here is not just another wife for the harem, but a lady to be the queen, or the second in command, like in the kingdom. And so look at verse 2 down to 4. Pretty well gives us the details of that. Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom. that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, under the custody of Hege, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things be for purification be given them. And let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. I'll have to commend the king for at least one thing here. When he was going about to marry a woman to be the queen, he expected her to be a virgin. I honestly believe that every young boy that goes to marry a girl has a right to expect her to be a virgin. What's regrettable is, according to statistics, 85% of all the girls now getting married are not virgins. And about 95% of all the boys are not virgins. You know, it's just as important for boys to be a virgin as it is for girls to be a virgin. We sometimes forget that, but the Bible is just as clear one way as it is the other way. So the king was very careful in that respect. I don't know, sometimes we have weddings today and we have the bride all dressed in white. And in fact, that's a symbol of purity, and it's just not true in many cases. It's actually nothing but hypocrisy, to be honest. But the king here definitely did believe that the queen had to be a virgin. Not only a virgin, but she had to be fair, she had to be young, and of course he had to be willing to accept her. I'm afraid there were a lot of things involved there. So he agrees that the servants have given good advice. Now, I don't know. It may be that they had some ulterior motives in what they did. This is just my supposition. Now, bear in mind that the king really wants to take back Vashti. Well, now, if you had been the fellows that had recommended that she be expelled as the queen, and you kind of got wind that he might be going to take her back, would you be upset? What do you think that woman would have done when she had been restored to the queenship? Well, probably those boys would have got the axe, as the old saying is. So I can imagine that from the political standpoint, the king felt like that he had to have a queen, and they felt like that it'd be good, and after all, he couldn't forget Vashti, so he's going to have another queen. And so they said, get another queen, and that way they could make sure that Vashti would not be restored and take vengeance against them. And so the king says, this is good, I'll go along with that. And so their steps were taken for the queen to be secured. Now, as we go on down, beginning there at verse 5, down through about verse 7, we have some of the family tree of Mordecai and Esther. And they're mentioned for the first time in the book thus far. And so let's start at verse 5 and see what we can find out about Mordecai. Now in Shushan, the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Now you'll observe something here. Mordecai is called a Jew, although he was from the tribe of Benjamin. So we might learn a little lesson from the historical standpoint. After the time of the destruction of the northern kingdom, and after the time of the fall of the southern kingdom of Benjamin and Judah, it seems to me that just about everybody, everywhere, was called a Jew, regardless of what tribe he was from. And here's proof of it. Because this man is of the tribe of Benjamin, but in fact he is being called here a Jew, a certain Jew. Some people have the idea that the Bible nowhere ever speaks of a Jew. And they say that Jesus was not a Jew. I hear a lot of weird stuff nowadays, but you recall that the Samaritan woman said to Christ that thou art a Jew. Why do you ask the question of me, a Samaritan? So Jesus was a Jew, just like old Mordecai was here in this verse. There's really no doubt about it. And his family tree is pretty well stated there, because he takes himself back all the way there to the time of the fall of Jerusalem. If we'll go and read the sixth verse, we can see that. who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity which had been carried away when Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. So then we find out a few facts here concerning the family tree of Mordecai. He goes all the way back to Kish. And there's a lot of argumentation as to what Kish this is. You may recall that Saul was the son of Kish. And there are some that maintain that this is the Kish that was the father of King Saul. But looking at the timetable involved, I don't believe that it can be, because there's too much time involved there. I believe they're wrong about that. Now, it is true that there is mention of a fellow by the name of Mordecai over there in Ezra chapter 2 and verse 2 and Nehemiah chapter 7 and verse 7. And he came with Zerubbabel from Babylon to Jerusalem, and then he returned to Persia again. And so some of them have reason that the Mordecai mentioned in Nehemiah and in Ezra is the same one in this book. But really, there's no way that they can be. Many people in that day had the same name, and so I would assume that this Kish is not the father of King Saul, but another Kish that we have no knowledge of, though he had that particular name. And I would also assume that the Mordecai in the book of Esther is a man that lived quite some time after the Mordecai that is mentioned there in Nehemiah and in the book of Ezra. And I'll give you a few reasons why that I say that. First of all, when you look at the construction, it seems to me that Kish was the one that was carried away from Jerusalem in the captivity by Nebuchadnezzar. And so he was the one carried away, not Mordecai. He had been born there, his father and grandfather, all the way back. They had been there in Persia all this time, so far as I can tell. Now, if we take the timetable that some use and say the Mordecai in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah is the one in this book, then Esther would have to be by this time 75 to 80 years old. Now, how in the world could you call a woman 75 and 80 years old a young virgin? It just simply wouldn't work out. But now, if we take the timetable that I've given, let this Kish be a man we don't really know anything about, other than he was of the tribe of Benjamin, and let Mordecai not be taken away in the captivity, but his grandfather, or we might ought to say there, his great-grandfather, really what it was, then we pretty well resolve the difficulty. That would allow Mordecai to be somewhere between 30 and 40 years old at this time, and would allow Esther to be in her 20s. And that would fit very well with the facts here that she was a fair, young virgin. And so I have to take the position there that this was a Kish that was not the father of Saul, and that the Mordecai in this book is certainly not the same one that is mentioned in the book of Ezra and in the book of Nehemiah. Well, so much for that. It really doesn't change much, but there's a lot of argumentation among scholars. Now let's look at some other facts that are stated here concerning Esther primarily this time. Incidentally, that is not her Hebrew name. Her Hebrew name is given here in verse 7, Hadashah. Her Persian name is Esther. He brought up Hadashah, that is Esther, and his uncle's daughter. So you see there, she would have been a cousin. For she had neither father nor mother. Now, of course, she had them, but they're dead. I presume that's what that means. And the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. So now we learn something here about Esther, or Hadashah, if you want to call her that. That's her real name. That's what her parents named her when she was born and all of that. That was her Hebrew name throughout her life, I'm sure. Hadashah in the Hebrew means myrtle. And she's there being compared to the fair myrtle tree. A very common tree in Palestine, a beautiful tree. The black myrtle is especially beautiful, I'm told. And in the book of Zechariah, chapter 1 and verse 8, Israel, the nation, is compared to a myrtle tree. So it was a symbol of God's people. And so very important symbol, I think, and perhaps they gave her the name of Hadassah to suggest that. But now she was given a Persian name, as we're going to see later, and the Persian name means star. And actually, if you check out the significance of the word, it means the star of Venus. And we're going to see in this lesson why she was given a Persian name and why that nobody called her Hadassah. And that's going to come out in what we see. But let's point out just a few basic facts here that I believe are important. This lady, in a way, was an orphan. That's the way she was at the time Mordecai took her in. She didn't have any father. She didn't have any mother. They were both dead. I wonder sometimes if you and I that had a father and had a mother ever realize how blessed we were not to be orphans. You ever thought about that? You know, there's a lot of love and affection that the mother and the father shows to their natural children. And have you ever thought how bad it was, especially in the 1800s and the Middle Ages, when these little orphans were thrown all in some old run-down building outside the town and had to more or less root hog or die, as we used to say down south. And a lot of times today it's really not much better than that. In a lot of places in the world, it's not even that good, and sometimes not very good here in our own country, I'm afraid. But I've seen a lot of kids that are orphans. And every time that I see an orphan, my heart always has gone out to them. And almost right on the spot, I'll bow my head and thank God that He did allow me to have a mother and a father and to grow up in a home where I was loved and cherished by them. It's something that we ought not to take for granted. So her predicament was bad. Her mother and her father was dead. She's in a foreign country. She's not in Judah. She's not among friends in the absolute sense. She's many miles from her homeland. So this orphan girl was indeed to be pitied. But you know, there was someone that God raised up to take care of her. And He was unto her as much a father as He possibly could be. I believe with all of my heart that He loved her as much as if she had been His own daughter by flesh and blood. Actually, that's about what we're told there when it said, when her mother and father were dead, took her for His own daughter. Meaning that He treated her as if she had been His natural daughter. Have you ever thought about how that God in the Bible has said that He's a friend to the orphans? You know, there's a lot of scriptures about orphans in the Bible. I don't think I've ever heard anybody preach a sermon on it. I was looking some of them up today, and they blessed my heart, and I hope they may have the same effect on you. Go over here to the book of Psalms, about three scriptures right quick. Psalms 10 and verse 18. Well, let's read verse 17 too. Lord, Thou hast heard the desire of the humble. Thou wilt prepare their heart. Thou wilt cause Thine ear to hear, to judge the fatherless and the oppressed, and the man of the earth, that the man of the earth may no more oppress the fatherless. That, of course, could be a bastard, or it could be someone that had lost a father. Anyway, we could think of them more in terms of an orphan, you see. Then look in the 27th Psalm at verse 10. A few scriptures on this matter of orphans. When my father and my mother forsake me, and there have been people that have lived to see that, then the Lord will take me up. It's really a sweet promise when you think about it, isn't it? And then over here in Psalm 68, and verse 5, there's still another scripture that to me is the greatest one in the Bible. Speaking about God, a father of the fatherless. In other words, the thought that I get when I read that is, if a person does not have a natural father, then God will be unto him as a father. A father of the fatherless and a judge of the widows is God in His holy habitation. You know, there are many scriptures in the Bible that tell us that we are to be kind unto the orphans, to the fatherless. For instance, the law in Israel, stated in Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 17, goes like this. Thou shalt not pervert the judgment of the stranger, nor of the fatherless. How many sad stories as a pastor I've heard over the years how that fatherless children were beat out of their inheritance by some crooked lawyer, by some fellow that claimed to be their friend and guardian, but in fact stole everything they had. It's happened many times. Nor of the fatherless, nor take a widow's raiment to pledge. And pretty much the same is said in the book of Exodus, chapter 22 and verse 22. Somebody said, well, that's all over in the Old Testament. Is there not anything in the New? Yes. In the book of James, chapter 1, verse 27, we're told what pure religion is, and according to that, maybe some of us don't have it. Maybe we haven't been as kind to the orphans as we ought to be, and to the widows and the like. Here's what it is. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this. Here's what it is now. Somebody said, oh, it's making a big talk about how good a Christian you are. No, it's what you do, not what you say. Look, to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction, and to keep himself unspotted from the world. If a man would be busy doing that, he probably wouldn't have time to get involved in the world too much, you see. So it would be a means of keeping him out of things that he probably didn't need to be into in the first place. So the Bible has much to say on this subject of the orphans and of widows and of the need of God's people being kind to them. Now there's another thing that we see here about this girl, Esther. She was fair and beautiful. You know, the Bible doesn't really say that there were a lot of women beautiful and fair, just a very few. But it says this of Esther. She was a most beautiful woman to behold. As a matter of fact, she was very impressive to the king and to the people there in the palace, as we're going to see. And her beauty was something to be desired, I'm sure, in that day. Now go on down to the 8th verse there, and from that 8th verse down to verse 11, we find out that Esther is favorably received there by the keeper of the women. In other words, he's impressed with this young Jewish girl in her 20s. And he's impressed with her in a way that you might not think at first. When you look carefully there, he's more or less impressed with her beauty and her behavior. It seems that two things got his attention. And so let's see there what we have as we read that 8th verse. So it came to pass when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, And when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan the palace, to the custody of Hegai, that Esther was brought also unto the king's house, to the custody of Hegai, keeper of the women. So now she's been brought here to the house, and probably quite a number of young virgins were brought from all over the empire. Josephus, the historian, says over 400 young girls were brought here to the house of the women at this time. I don't know, the Bible doesn't give the number, but from what has been said before, there's no doubt a large number of virgins coming. Now think about something. The most unlikely woman in all the land of Persia, out of that 120 some odd provinces that he ruled over, the most unlikely candidate to be the queen would have been an orphan girl from a foreign country. Now, if everybody looked around and said, now, I believe this lady will be the queen, or that lady will be the queen, about the last one on the list would have been Esther. She'd have been right down on the bottom. But you know, God is a God of providence. He does not only the strange, but what at times to us seems to be impossible. So what we're about to see in this chapter is how that a humble woman was exalted. And what we saw in chapter 1 was how that a proud woman was debased. And so the chapters are just the opposite one of the other like that. Well, she gets in touch with this keeper of the women there. As we go on to look at the 9th verse. And the maiden pleased him, that is, this keeper of the women. And she obtained kindness of him. And he speedily gave her all things for purification, with such things as belonged to her, and 7 maidens, which were meet to be given her out of the king's house. And he preferred her and her maids unto the best place of the house of the women. So I would assume from the way that reads that there were various quarters like in the house of the women, various rooms or chambers, whatever you'd like to call it. And in the very choice chamber of this house of women was put Esther and her seven maiden companions. I can't help but as I read about these seven companions there to think about the bride and the bridegroom in the parable of the ten virgins. You had ten maids there that were waiting on the bride. Here you have seven. It was not unusual for them to have quite a number of young ladies, bridesmaids and the like, to wait on them. And so that's what was taking place here, so far as I'm able to ascertain. Now, I don't know exactly what this man thought of her, but I assume that her beauty and her behavior caught his attention. Because I can imagine that she was a well-behaved woman, and that got his attention. Probably some of these ladies may not have been quite of that order, is why I said that. There's quite a bit of difference probably in these heathen women of Persia and this young Jewish girl that believed in God and in the Bible. And so I'm sure that even this man, though he was a pagan, could see that. You know, whenever Christians associate with the world, they ought to be able to have some mark of distinction there that'll identify. You ought to be able to tell a person that believes in God from one that don't. And people that associate with the children of God ought to be able to take knowledge of us that we've been with Jesus. And it's a sad day when we're out in the world and they can't tell any difference between us and the world. And most of the time when that's so, it's because there is no difference. Because all of them are lost going to the same place. That's about what I've got to say about that. Now let's go on to the 10th verse because some rather odd things are shaping up here. Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. Now he didn't tell her to lie about what her country was or to lie about her family tree. He just said, don't tell it at the present time. Now we might learn a little practical lesson right there. It may be wise sometime not to speak all the truth all the time. Now before you disagree with that, you look at the context and tell me whether or not that lesson's taught here. For instance, I talked to a young lady today who was greatly disturbed about some of the doctrines that we believe here. She had grown up and not knowing anything about the sovereignty of God. She had grown up with the idea that you got to pray through and you got to sit on the mourner's bench and all this type of thing to be saved. And she had all these different ideas about the way of salvation. Well, in just a few moments, I could have said enough to make her furious. She would have gone into a rage and probably hung up the phone after she'd called me and not even let me talk any longer. But you know how much truth I told her? All that I felt like she could take at that time. And as time progresses, I'll tell her more and more. You say, well, I don't believe we ought to do that. Now, wait a minute. What did the Lord do? He said to his disciples one time, I have many things to say unto you, but ye are not able to bear it. And I think we sometimes do a lot of harm in the Lord's cause by giving people an overdose. You know, if a fellow eats too much at the table, it'll make him sick. Well, I think a lot of our Sovereign Grace Baptists may drive a lot of people away, not because they haven't told them the truth, but they need to learn the simple lesson that you don't always tell all the truth all the time. It's not wise to. Now, he didn't tell this girl to lie about the situation, but he told her just to do what would be orderly and decent at this particular time. She was not to lie under any circumstance. There's never a time that we ought to engage in telling an untruth. I don't believe that Mordecai nor Esther would have engaged in anything like that. So you say, well, now why didn't you just go in there and say, well, I'm of the tribe of Judah. I'm a Benjaminite and all this. Well, that wouldn't have been a very wise thing to do. As a matter of fact, it probably would have hindered the providence of God here and what it was trying to accomplish. So Mordecai was using good common sense. And so was Esther, so far as I can tell. Now, why do you suppose that she's going to get this new name of Esther? Well, I think there was a good reason for that. You see, this man who is in charge of the women, he wants to help her out a little bit. And if she has a Persian name, she can pass in the presence of the king, not as one out of the Jews in Jerusalem, but can pass as a native Persian. And so this man really was doing her a favor, getting her this name of Esther. And so there's going to be some, well, little work going on there to take care of that. So they're calling her Esther. Not Hadassah, but Esther. Because that's a Persian name. That would have been a common name in that day. It's a common name in our land. I've known many ladies that have the name of Esther. One preacher's wife comes to mind now. Now let's see what else we find as we go on down to look at the next verse. You'll find what I'd call a disturbed father. And as a matter of fact, he's acting about like most fathers act just before the daughters get married. Now, if you've ever had a daughter to get married, I've had one. It makes you a little uncomfortable when they're going to marry and move off maybe 1,800 miles away from home. It don't make you feel too good. And sometimes you kind of walk the floor, sort of like old Mordecai did here. And he had a lot of questions. Of course, he had more to worry about than I did, probably some of you, because of some reasons I'm about to point out. So let's look at that 11th verse. And Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. We learn a little bit right there. Mordecai is a pretty important man in the government, or he couldn't be going up and down the hall there where the harem of the women were. Matter of fact, that could have got a man killed in that day, plundering around up there at the king's palace. So he has some position. I gather from what follows in verse 21 that he was a keeper of the door at the main entrance of the palace. That simply means that all of the eunuchs going in and out of the harem would have had to pass by him, and he could have asked questions about what was going on in the house of the women. So that's probably how he got his information, if I had to guess. So now here he is. He's going up and down before the court of the women, near to where this place is, right outside the door, as it were. So, well, he must be a little disturbed. He's walking up and down. He's wondering what's going on. Well, I don't know all the thoughts that passed through his mind, but I'd say that he's pretty much distressed for a number of reasons. He knew that, according to their law, it was wrong for a Jew to marry a Gentile. And so if Xerxes married Esther, and she became the queen, then this woman would marry a Gentile, contrary to the rules of their nation. I guess that bothered him. Maybe he said, if she marries the king, and he finds out that she is of Judah and of the captives of Judah, a slave, more or less, of this kingdom, will he not divorce her and put her away as he did Vashti? Or maybe even have her put to death? Well, I don't know all the thoughts that went through his mind. I guess he might have asked a few other questions. Said, I know that Esther believes in the true God, and she wants to observe the Sabbath day, and she wants to read in the law of God, and how is she going to do that in the presence of the king of Persia? So he saw a lot of problems for Esther. A lot of problems concerning her religion. A lot of problems concerning many other things there that could happen to her while she was in the house of the women. Maybe some of the other ladies that wanted to be queen, maybe they'd rise up and kill her since she was a foreigner. And maybe they knew about her. So I can see a very disturbed man. No wonder he went up and down. He's concerned about her. And I believe we ought to be concerned about the welfare of our children. We ought to be concerned about who they're going to marry and how that the marriage is going to work out. We ought to be concerned about their welfare and their health and all these things. Surely ought to be concerned of every parent, as far as I can tell. And then we go down to verse 12 to 17 pretty quick and see how that she pleases the king and see a little bit about the terrible degradation of womanhood in the days of the Persian Empire. In case you ladies think you're being discriminated against, consider this. And then decide if you've got it good or you got it bad in the light of how these ladies had it. Now, when every maid's turn was come to go in to King Ahasuerus, after that she had been 12 months, according to the manner of the women, for so were the days of their purifications accomplished, to wit, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with sweet odors, and with other things for the purifying of the women. So before any woman could be married to the king, for 6 months she had to have myrrh rubbed into her skin, and then for 6 more months, sweet perfume and spices of all kinds. Now that was to remove all body odor, to make her skin very soft, and during the course of 12 months to make sure that she was not with child. All of these things were a part of the 12-month purification period that's spoken of here. Now, let's note some other things as we go further there to verse 13 and 14. And you'll find how bad, maybe, that some of the wives, these concubines, had it in that day. There probably were 300 or 400 of these, if I had to guess, too. Then thus came every maid unto the king. Whatsoever she desired was given her to go with her out of the house of the women unto the king's house. And that simply meant that all of these young virgins from all over the empire that's there, probably 300 or 400 of them, in that same house where there's probably 300 or 400 concubines as well, already married to the king, quite a crew of women there in the harem, if I had to guess at this time, that they're given whatever jewelry they want, the finest dress, whatever they got in mind, that they're given that so as to try to impress the king. Now they go in and pass in review before him, because out of these he's going to choose the one that'll be the new queen in Persia. And so they're going in from time to time. They just go in, make one appearance like, and that's all of it. You go back, and that's not so good. So it says in verse 14, in the evening she went, and on the morrow she returned into the second house of the women, to the custody of Sheashgaz, the king's chamberlain, which kept the concubines. She came in unto the king no more, except the king delighted in her, and that she was called by name. So now you'll learn something here about these secondary wives of the king of Persia. It may have been that they never spent but one night with their husband. They were sent back out to the house of women. They would never again have any dealings with the king, maybe would never even see his face for the rest of their life. They couldn't marry anybody else. They had to stay out there in the house of women, shut up from the world. And most of all, the men they saw were all eunuchs that were in charge of the harem. And so they couldn't go anywhere. They couldn't see the king. They were just incarcerated, as it were. Well, I believe the ladies ought to have a great deal to be thankful for concerning Christianity, because it's done more to lift womanhood from degradation than anything else that's ever come to this world. Here's how it was back in that day. Not a very good time to live, wouldn't you say? Well, that's the way it was, though. Well, let's look at a few other verses here quickly and close. Verse 15. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go in unto the king, she required nothing but what Hegai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. She was very obedient to this man. Whatever he said, put on. Whatever he told her to do, she did it. No wonder he liked her. I suppose that'd go over with almost any man, wouldn't it? If he always had a lady doing what he told her to. So no wonder this old fellow tried to help her out and did what he did here to help her become the queen. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. She must have behaved well and looked well, and everybody was impressed. She obtained favor. So Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus into his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. So there's your timetable. And if you want to know what time of the year it was, that was about December and January, the way we count time. So it would have been right at the end, like, of the 7th year of his reign. So she didn't go back to the house where the concubines were. According to this, she stayed somewhere in the palace in an ideal place. And so that pretty well indicated that it wouldn't be too long until she would be the queen. I suppose that the old king had just about made up his mind, best I can tell by this time. Though we'll find out in the next verse that a final decision like was made and all of that. But so there's some very important lessons in this about how we ought to treat orphans, concerns that we ought to have for the marriage of our children, the importance of many other practical things. We've tried to bring these out in this lesson. And I believe they're all for our spiritual edification. Well, let us stand.